Hi, my name is Al V. I am an alcoholic and a drug addict, and I'm glad to be here. I know I was asked to step in if I had to, and I never say no. When I have a chance to do some service work, I try to always say yes. You know, since I've only got 10 minutes, and I only have about 30 years of drinking to talk about, this synopsis is, you know, the first day of school for me in the little town of Ayer, Massachusetts, was a frightening thing. I still remember like it was yesterday because I didn't speak a word of English in a little town in Massachusetts. And I remember my parents, my mother spoke broken English. My father couldn't hardly speak any at all. And they were talking to the school administrators about my language barrier. And I remember the principal telling my mother, I says, don't worry. We'll put your son up front so he can hear. It'd be no problem, okay? There's absolutely nothing wrong with my ears, okay? But they put me up front, and I got to watch the mouths move, you know? And they socially promoted me up to the grades. They said, well, he'll catch up when he starts learning how to speak English a little better. And, you know, it took me 3 or 4 years before I was fluent enough to understand and speak English. Except I was always behind everybody. And it was kind of a small little town. It was a little, small little military town. God bless you, my son. So, you know, I was always behind. And the locals, you know, knew that. And I was in the fourth, fifth grade, and I couldn't spell. I couldn't read, really. I could speak, but, you know. And when the new military kids come in from the fort, I try to make new friends. Hey, what's your name? Hey, you just got here, yay. And the locals tell him, hey, don't hang around that kid. He's a foreigner. He's stupid. He's ignorant. He can't read. He can't write. And that's how I felt about myself, you know. All those years, I tried to hide that I couldn't read, I couldn't write. And I learned how to hide my feelings and how to really be somebody else because I didn't want to be who I was. You know, I was less than. I wasn't as good as everybody else, you know. And I remember the first time that, that's funny, you know, my mother worked hard, my father worked hard, and after school would, you know, not take the bus because we can run through the fields and through the woods back to my house before the bus could get there. And we'd run back there because my parents were gone and we'd have the house ourselves. Me and my two buddies, John and Dave, because they were outcasts too. And we had a little clique going, and we always go to my brother's room. Not my oldest brother. He wanted to be a state cop. My next oldest brother. You know, he was cool. He's Afro, a hippie, you know. And we'd go in his room looking for Playboys or Hustler, you know, to look at the pictures, right? And we couldn't find him one day, and we found this magazine called High Times Magazine. Okay, High Times Magazine was a magazine with nothing but marijuana, and we're looking through this, and we're seeing pictures of these half-naked girls smoking pot by the Golden Gate Bridge, and they have flowers in their hair, and going, wow, this is who I want to be, right here, you know. And I says, what is this pot stuff, you know? And we're reading about it. I said, where do you get it? Where do you get this magic stuff? I said, I don't know, but I knew a senior, so I'll tell you what, I'm gonna bring this to school tomorrow, and I'm gonna ask John. Let's see, maybe he'll know where to get it. So next day, I went and asked this guy, hey. Where do you get this marijuana stuff? He looks down, right, and looks at me and goes, kid, you don't need that to get high. Really? No, you want to get high? So you just get some bananas, okay? You peel the bananas, and then you dry the banana peels, and you smoke them, you'll get high as kite. Really? Wow, great, yeah. So me and my two buddies, John and Dave, went out to Tom's Food World, right, and right off the bat, I knew there was, it should have been a sign, okay, because we didn't buy a bunch of bananas. No. We bought like 50 pounds of bananas, okay? We wanted to be dealers right off the bat, okay? So for 3 days, we peeled bananas and we dried them like a little factory, you know, in the backyard. and then it was ready. It was ready. It was. So we ran home, ran to my house, right, shut my bedroom door, and we got this corn cob pipe. And we stuffed it, and then we lit it on fire, and it was popping, exploding. It was getting our eyes. We kept smoking it. And God, I got the worst headache I've ever got in my life. You know? and going, man, if this is getting high, I don't want nothing to do with it, you know? And all of a sudden the door burst in, and it's my older brother, right, the hippie one, and he goes, look, what the hell's thing? It smells like burnt bananas, you know? And he looks down, you know, and her tears are rolling down her eyes, and he goes, hey, give me that pipe. He goes in his room and taps it out, and in it he had Acapulco gold. He put some gold, he put some hash, he put a little bit of opium, a little more gold. Here, boys, smoke that. And we smoked that, okay? And for the first time in my life, I didn't feel stupid. I didn't feel ignorant, I didn't feel less than, okay? Man, I felt great. I mean, I felt like that was the meaning of life, to feel that happy, that joyous. I mean, I had a goldfish, right? That goldfish was moving its mouth, and we were like throwing jokes in its mouth. He was doing, you know, that goldfish was doing stand-up comedy. It was killing us. That fish was the funniest fish I've ever saw in my life. And we were dying, you know? And the next day, you know, the next day, we, you know, the school bus, you know, we were waiting for the school bus, and we look at each other, and goes, wasn't that something? I said, yeah, man. You know, first words out of my mouth were, man, the little pot did that for us. What some Budweiser's would do for us? I said, yeah. I said, yeah. So we started scheming and planning right off the bat, okay? That weekend, I think it was right before the end of school, it was in June, sometime it was hot, and that Saturday morning, I mean, like 7 o'clock in the morning, okay, I was out front of the air package store. Now, the air package, air has one main street, okay, some businesses. Now, the air package store, okay, was half a block big. It's the biggest store there for the GIs and everything else. And I was out front from 7 o'clock in the morning when they opened, asking people, hey, will you buy us a case of beer? Will you buy us a case of beer? Get away, go away, go away. Now it's like noontime, and I'm still asking everybody to walk by, you know? And finally, this GI walks by, and I think he was like 15, you know, his greens on, and I asked him, hey, you want to buy us a case of beer? And he just walked by us, and then he stopped, he turned around, he looked at me. I could swear we're about the same age. I was about 15, and he says, how much money you got? I go, I don't know. I reached my pocket, I pulled out all the bills, the quarters and dimes and nickels, and gave it to him. He goes, kid, don't you have a wallet? I go, Jesus, you know? So he straightened the bills out, and says, all right. He told me, hey, walk around back and wait for me. I said, okay, great, thank God. Well, I went around back, and, you know, the railroad tracks were there, the old tannery was back there and stuff, and we waited, and we waited, and we waited. God, we're kicking this, you know, the dirt. God, we're ripped off. I can't believe it. And they're telling me, Al, you should have went back there, and you should have went in there with them. I go, what? He's a soldier. He's a trained killer. What am I going to do, you know? And finally, we were trying to see what we're going to do, right? And all of a sudden, around the corner of the building, here he comes. He's got a case, a 16-ounce tall boy Budweiser's, ice cold, the water just dripping off him, right? And it was Nirvana, you know? It's like, I can almost hear the angels singing behind him, you know? And we were like staring at him, couldn't believe it. Our eyes were like popping over our heads. And he comes up, and he says, here, grab one. Each of us grabbed a six-pack. He grabbed a six-pack for himself. And he says, enjoy life, boys, while you can. Aye, aye, Captain. And, you know, we ran down the dirt tracks and into the dirt by the pond. And we didn't ask him for napkins or glasses or anything, you know. We weren't going to pour it in mugs and pour a little pinky up and sip them, you know. We didn't know what the hell we were doing. We were just chugging them as fast as possibly could until it was coming out of our noses, you know. And we got stewed, okay. And we were running around naked, jumping in this, like Indians in a coal mine. I mean, we had a great time, you know, and we just passed out there in the banks of that pond, and you know, the morning sun came up, and you know how the fog was over the water, you know, it's like the morning dew, and I woke up and had charcoal dust on me, and we puked on ourselves, and you know, I woke up, my buddies, John and Dave. John, Dave, come on, wake up. He says, man, we didn't tell our parents we were going to be out all night. Come on, we're in trouble. And, you know, they wake up, and we wake up, and he's got puke on him, and I got puke on me, you know. And I said, wasn't that great? Yeah, man. And that was it. From that day on, you know, there was no more trying to get good marks in school. There was no more trying out for the baseball team, basketball team, nothing. The only thing that was in my life was where am I going to get the money, who's going to buy the booze, and where we're going to drink it. That was it. That was the big three of my life from that point on. I had a mission, is to get screwed up. You know, that's it. That a week or two later, I remember being across the street from Air High School, okay, in an apple orchard, drinking 16-ounce Budweisers from my three buddies, smoking joints before homeroom, okay? And trust me on this, that kind of activity is not conducive to higher education, okay? When you start school, buzzed out, okay? You know, my drinking didn't get any better than that. At 17, I think I was a sophomore, okay? I got a full-time job. I moved out of my parents' house because it got in the way of my drinking. My parents just didn't see eye to eye about my drinking. So I got an apartment. I started drinking every day. I delivered newspapers. As soon as I got my license, I got this paper out in a van, delivering to the newspaper boys in some houses in Fort Devens. And so they let me out, work release, I called it, from school early so I can do my afternoon route. And I had my own apartment. Started dealing pot and crystal meth. Started drinking every day. My apartment was a party house for the kids in high school. I started seeing this 30-year-old blonde petite girl lady that was married but liked the crank, and I had an Austin Healey sports car. I mean, I was living large at 17 years old. And you know, one day I was thrown. I had a new shipment of meth come in. And these GIs were coming over and calling me up, hey, you got any stuff? Yeah, bring a case of beer. And these GIs came over and taught me how to play spades. I said, hey, you know how to play spades now? It's okay, you know how to play spades, you make your books and you go on. I said, yeah. I sat at this table playing spades with these guys for 3 days, solid, without getting off the table, okay? People were coming in and phone would ring, yeah, bring some more beer. And the next thing I know, the place was just jammed for 3 days. They were throwing a party, I didn't even know it. And people from Boston, from Newton, I'm going, hey, who are you? And they said, well, where are you from? I'm from Newton. Really? Wow, this is before the internet. You know what I mean? I mean, word of mouth. Also, I'm throwing a party, you know? But then I got tired. I got really, really tired. I said, everybody, out. And this is they just passed a law for nickel deposits in the cans, so they didn't have anybody throw any cans away. You know, and that has cases of empties just stacked up everywhere, like, you know, stalactites in a cave, in a bat cave. And, so I kicked everybody out, locked the door, and I said, I need some sleep, you know, and I haven't eaten in a week, and I went to sleep. But what I didn't know is that I had caught hepatitis, and I wasn't going to sleep. I went into a coma, okay, and I went in there to die, literally, and... you know, the music was on, the lights were on, people were knocking, pounding on the door, but I wasn't answering the door. My Austin Healey was up front. And finally, after 2 or 3 days of that, somebody put their shoulders to the door, and they busted in, and they went upstairs, and they saw me in my bed that was yellow, they said. I was yellow, like, you know, dog urine in the snow. And my liver had exploded through my rib cage, and I had urinated, defecated myself in my bed, and just one look at me, and they went down, they ran out of the place, and they called my mother's house, my parents' house. My father answered the phone, and they told him, no, you better get here, your son's dead. And my father told me that he didn't tell my mother where it was going, he just went, I never let my parents in my apartment, never, okay, because I knew that the way I was living was no way to show that to your parents, you know. But my father went upstairs, and he says he saw me, he couldn't believe it, that I was his son. He couldn't recognize me. He said he picked me up and I weighed absolutely nothing. So I was still in a coma. And he took me to the air emergency room, and he brought me in, and he said that the nurse took one look at me and cleared the emergency room, because he knew hepatitis when he saw it. It was yellow, and the doctor comes running in, and he does a little flashlight thing to my eyeballs, you know? And he turns to my father and he says, shakes his head and says, make arrangements, this one's not going to make it, you know? And my father started crying. He says that it's sad because Yeah, with this disease, the only people you hurt with this disease is those people who love you, okay? Because nobody else gives a shit if you live or die. But those who love you can see it, can see you killing yourself, and there's nothing they can do about it, okay? And I learned that firsthand. But this disease is powerful, you know? And the doctors just, there's nothing you can do about this kid, you know? But days went by. And a week went by, 2 weeks went by, I was still in a coma, I was still alive, the doctors were amazed I was still alive, you know, and after 2 weeks I woke up, you know, the doctor was like, God, you know, says, why are you still alive, they can't figure it out, you know, but for the grace of God, it wasn't my time, you know, and of course I was sitting there in isolation, I figured it out, what happened, you know, why did my life get that way? You know, it took a long time to get that idea in my head of what caused this, okay? And the answer to me was all my damn friends, you know? It was those loser people that come into my house, wanted a drink, wanted drugs. That's what caused me to be the way I am, okay? Of course, the disease was talking to me. I didn't know what I didn't know, okay? Of course, I wanted to blame anybody else besides me, okay? So they actually socially promoted me right out of high school. And they gave me my diploma because I had enough credits and everything. And now my drinking just took off from there too. I mean, I didn't learn nothing, absolutely nothing. I took, you know, I was eight. I forget how old I was at the time. I took a wife at 19. She just turned 18. Took a job in an electronics firm because I was really good in electronics. I won state fairs. I excelled in electronics. And they sent me to Europe. I took my wife and. You know, as soon as I hit Amsterdam, you know, I found out the bars closed for 1 hour between 5 a.m. and 6 a.m. to sweep the place out and then go back and drink. I was drinking around the clock. I mean, Amsterdam is like, Jesus, you know? It's like a kid in a candy store. I'd take off on a Friday when I get paid and not come home till Monday morning, 6, 7 o'clock in the morning, so I can take a shower, put my shirt and tie on, and go to the office. My poor wife, my 18-year-old wife, would be in the fetal position, crying all week and waiting for her husband to come home, you know? And hell no, I'm gone, forget it. And one day I came home on a Saturday and she goes, oh, you're home, I can't believe it. Here's a plane ticket that leaves tomorrow, be on it. I don't want to be married to you no more. And she cried and begged me not to do that. But I didn't know anything about hurting people. I didn't know anything about feelings. I didn't know anything about love because I've been drinking since I was 14 years old, you know? And she begged me not to do that. I remember like yesterday, and I said, just be on that damn airplane. And she was. She was afraid of me while I was drinking. And, you know, there goes one marriage. Whoop. Drank that one right away. You know, and I cut down. When I got back, I signed the divorce papers, and she was gone, and I was on my way. And to celebrate, I bought a new motorcycle. And, you know, my life is totally out of control. I didn't know it. I lived to drink. I lived to drug. I worked to drink. To drug and drink. That's it. I had no future, no nothing. The only thing I wanted to do was the next paycheck so I could drink it away. You know, and I asked this young lady to live next door, come over for a drink and a line, and she did. And 2 years later, she's still there. Okay, and and one day she says to me, I come home from work with a beer, right, as usual for the drive home, and she says, Al, I got something to tell you. You better sit down. Oh, yeah? What? She says, I'm pregnant. I jump up, I shake her hand, congratulations. No, you drunken fool, it's your kid. Oh, my kid? What the hell are you talking about? You know, I must have been on a blackout or something, you know? And I must have had a hole in it. As soon as she found out she was pregnant, she stopped snorting coke. She stopped drinking. She stopped doing everything. She stopped smoking cigarettes. I said, good, more for me, you know? And the company sent me to Denmark this time, you know? And she was pregnant. I mean, she was really pregnant. And I had to sign these waivers that if she was going to have the baby on the airplane was my responsibility to deliver it. No problem. Hey, just give me a couple of drinks. I'll take care of that, you know. So we touched down in a Skjold airport in Denmark, and we had our son there in Denmark. He had dual citizenship for a while, and the nurses hated when it came in there because he was premature, like 2 months, and he was in an incubator, and they had a bed for my wife next to him so she can give him mother's milk. And that whole story was something else. She gave me a list of things to buy, and one of them was a breast pump. And I went off in Copenhagen. All right, they were speaking Dutch, and I'm trying to find a breast pump and try to get this conveyed to what I needed. Get out of here. Finally, I found a pharmacist that spoke some English. We got it done. But that was something else. But the nurses just hated when I came in there, because I always came in with a big thing of wine, give it to the other patients, and a little party going on. It's hard to see my son had a little party going on. But, you know, when we got back to the States, you know, my wife, you know, I went right back to, you know, blowing all my money on Coke, drinking around the clock, not coming home after work, you know. Electricity being shut off, landlord pounding on the door looking for his money. And my wife sat me down, and my son was 2 years old. And I remember, like, it was yesterday, she was holding him in the kitchen, and she's telling me, "Al, you have to do something about drinking. You're drugging. There's no way to raise our son. So we got to put him first." He says, "You got to stop drinking. You got to stop it right now, or I'm going to leave." And I remember just flinging the door open. "Yeah, if you're going to leave, get the hell out now. I ain't stopping drinking for nobody." You know, and she started crying, and my son was crying, and she just left, got in a car, drove off, and I slammed the door behind her. You know, she can't live without me, the provider, the great I am, thinking I'm all that, and a bag of chips too. You know, she didn't need me. She didn't need anything, okay? She got sober. She found the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. She got herself a big book. She got herself a sponsor. She got herself a damn good lawyer and didn't need my ass for nothing. Trust me on this, okay? Because I always thought she'd be back in a couple of days, you know? And she never came back. And my drinking just took off. And I would drink at her. I hated her for taking my son away from me. It was all her fault, you know? Every time I go to my local bar, the bartender would roll his eyes, you know, "Oh, here it comes." You know, I'd be screaming, yelling, that F and that this and that, and, you know, drinking. And, you know, after a while, the booze stopped working. It just stopped working. It stopped. And then when I started drinking, I started crying. So I missed my wife and I missed my son. I remember once after closing the bars, my motorcycle. And this apartment we had, 9-foot ceilings, hardwood floors, beautiful place. But now the place looked like an animal lived there. A couch that I found on the side of the road. There's no drapes, no furniture to speak of. I remember closing the bars, coming home, and my motorcycle boots on the hardwood floor. Man, the noise was like echoing, you know, and it was like deafening. I had a buzz in my head from smoking cigarettes and snorting Coke and drinking and smoking more cigarettes, and it was just the hum in my head, like a 60-cycle hum, like white noise, and it was deafening. And I look around, and it was a place where my son used to play, and I remember him playing in the Tonka toys I bought him, and my wife cooking in the kitchen, the smell of her cooking, and my son's laughter playing, and I remember those memories just come flooding back, and I remember feeling alive, you know, and I just fell to my knees and start crying, because I felt so lonely, so empty. You know, and I woke up there the next day. Oh, what the hell happened there? You know, and I took a shower and I went to work, and I started drinking the way home as usual. And by the time I got to where I lived, I started crying in my beer. I couldn't hide the pain no more. I couldn't hide the emptiness. The booze wasn't filling me up anymore. You know, And I remember I couldn't stop crying. And about 5 o'clock, 4 o'clock in the morning or so, I called my ex-wife up. You know, she was the only sober person I knew. And, you know, I pick up the phone and I said, hello. Actually, I didn't say anything. She said hello. And I think I said, it's me. And dead silence on the phone. And she says to me, are you ready? Now, I never talked about me getting sober or the program or nothing, but I knew, but for the grace of God, I knew exactly what she was talking about. And I said, yes, I'm ready. She says, good, it's about time. Pack a suitcase. I come right there and pick you up. You stay right there. So I packed a suitcase, put all my dirty clothes in there. Everything I owned was dirty. And I sat there, and the sun came up. Birds were chirping, and I hated those birds. Because every time I heard the birds, I knew I did it again. Up all night, had to go to work, you know. But this time, I hear the beep, beep of that car horn. And I knew that car horn well because the judge made me pay for it. So I knew who was out there. So I got in the car, and immediately she drove off. And I looked out the window. I wouldn't look at her. I wouldn't look at her because I was crying, you know. And I didn't ask her where we were going. I didn't ask her what we were doing or nothing. I just kept looking out the window, and she kept driving north, you know. And every package store, do you need a drink? And I'm shaking and crying. I go, no, I'm fine. No, yeah, I'm fine, all right. And about an hour and a half, 2 hours later, we go to this town in up northern New Hampshire called Spofford. And in it, there's a place called Spofford Hall. It's a rehab center. And she parks the car. And I just get out. And she calls me over and says, Al, come here. I said, there's a bed waiting there for you. You have great insurance. I says, she says, you got two choices. I go, what? She says, go in there and do something up with your alcoholism, your drug addiction. Or, I go, yeah. Or you can walk home. She drives off. Well, there's my decision, huh? You know, and I wish I could say that I went in there. And I did go in there, and I did stay for the whole 28 days, and I learned about my alcoholism and my drug addiction. And I learned about the compulsion after their first drink. And I learned about Alcoholics Anonymous. They used to take us to meetings, so I went to a meeting and knew about the program. At least I was educated. And they told me, as soon as you get out of, as soon as you get out of here, go right to a meeting, get yourself a sponsor, get yourself a meeting list book, and start going every day. You know, when I left that place, you know, they give me this coin. He says, Al, I'm going to give you this coin, you know. And it's a bunch of bullshit, probably, because they said, we don't give this to everybody. We only give it to people who think we're going to make it. Oh, really? I really bullshit them, didn't I? You know? Because when I left that place, I joined AA, Al's Anonymous, okay? Al's Anonymous didn't work, okay? And I was back out there about 3 months later. I stayed white knuckling for about 3 months in my program. And, you know, but when the loneliness came back, when it beat me back down to the ground again, okay, and I couldn't stop crying because the spiritlessness, emptiness inside me, I wanted to kill myself. At least I knew where to go, you know, and I remember there was a meeting that actually I went to twice after I got out of Spofford Hall. I'd parked the car and looked at everybody in the rearview mirror while I finished my cigarette, and they'd be on the back door smoking cigarettes, laughing, joking, and then they'd go in one at a time until there was nobody left. And there was nobody back there. I just put it in reverse and took off, you know. But one day when I really needed it, because I wanted to stop drinking, I had no program, I had nobody to talk to. I remember the sponsor, my counselor once telling me, if you ever needed help and you had nobody, get on your knees and ask for help, you just might get it. And that day I did. You know, I was like a caged animal, and I got on my knees and I prayed for help. I prayed God to help me through this, and you know, when I got up, I felt better. I wasn't shaking and I wasn't crying, and I remember that meeting. It was only like 2 or 3 blocks down the street, and it was January. At this time, it was January in New England, and I got my jacket and I looked at my car, and I was afraid to drive because I might drive to the package store or to the bar, so I just started walking. And by the time I got to the back door, you know, I was shaking and crying still. It was so cold. It was just minus 20 degrees out there, you know, and somebody was at the back door. In Massachusetts, they had greeters, okay? So it was a sign to greet people as they came in. And when I came in, the greeter just shook my hand, you know, and he said, "Welcome to the Clegone Original Group." And he got me to a chair and sat me down and got me a half a cup of coffee. He said, "Here you go, it's coffee." He says, "It's free, you know, just listen." And I was sitting there shaking and drinking, and I don't know what was said, but I stayed in that chair that whole entire meeting. And at the end, after the Lord's Prayer, he comes back and he has a meeting list, and he had circled, he had highlighted a meeting. He said, "I'm going to be at this meeting tomorrow night. You come, I'll meet you there." I said, "Okay." And you know, the next night, I found the place, and he was there. And then after that meeting, he said, "Here, I'm going to be at this meeting here. Why don't you be there?" Okay. And after the third or fourth night, these old timers started passing me around for 2 weeks, talking where all the meetings were. And after the 2 weeks, when the old timers told me, "Okay, Al, you know where all the meetings are now. Your recovery's up to you. Okay? Get yourself to a meeting every day for 90 days. Find yourself a sponsor and do the program the way it's laid out, and you'll be all right." That's exactly what I did. Okay, I brought myself to a meeting. Every day, I've got myself a sponsor, and he helped me through the steps. You know, my sobriety date is New Year's Day. Because that New Year's night in 1988, okay, I had it. Okay, I had it. And New Year's Day was the first day of my sobriety. Okay, and I haven't had a need to pick up another drink. I have not needed to smoke a joint or any substitutes, okay, for the fellowship of this program. This program saved my life, okay, and I'll be coming back, okay, because these meetings, I need these meetings. I need these meetings to stay sober, and that's the only reason why I'm alive today, because I'm sober. And I really do appreciate you being here for me every time I'm here. I love seeing you guys. If it wasn't you guys, I wouldn't be coming. Okay, and I'd be dead. So thanks.
Thank you.